All right, picture this. It's a random Tuesday morning. You're standing in line at a cafe, you're staring at the menu, and you're having that classic debate, right? Do I drop $5 on this oat milk latte? Or just, suck it up and drink the free stuff back at the office? Or, hey, zoom out a bit. Maybe you're at the kitchen table late at night, looking at your bank balance, trying to figure out how much to move to the 401k versus, what to keep liquid for that vacation.
And it feels like such a private moment, doesn't it? Just you, your bank account, and your choices.
Exactly. But here's the thing, and this is really the core of the deep dive we're tackling today, that split-second decision. It isn't just about your caffeine fix. That decision is actually the engine of the entire global economy. We are talking about household consumption.
And we are doing it through a pretty heavy hitter of a text. We're unpacking Chapter 11, Consumption by Giovanni L. Violante. And I should warn you, if you were to look this up, it is full of Greek letters, lots of calculus. It's a dense, rigorous text.
But our mission today is to sort of strip away the calculus and get at the human behavior underneath. Because really, this text is trying to answer a really fundamental human question. How do we cope with the chaos of life? When the car breaks down or you get a bonus, how does that shock actually filter through to your daily existence?
Or does it filter through at all? That's really the key. Do we panic or do we have ways to smooth it all out?
So let's start where Violante starts. He lays out these two theoretical benchmarks, two extreme ways a person could exist in an economy. I kind of think of them as the nightmare and the utopia.
That's a very fair way to put it. Yeah. Let's start with the nightmare, which economists call autarky.
Autarky. It sounds like a bad sci-fi government, but in this context, it's basically the Robinson Crusoe model, isn't it?
Precisely. In autarky, you're an economic island. You eat exactly what you kill. There's no banking system, no one to borrow from, no insurance.
So let's play that out. If I'm living in autarky and I say break my leg and can't work on Tuesday.
Then you consume zero on Tuesday. It is the definition of volatility. There's 100% pass-through from your income to your consumption. If your income drops by half, your life drops by half. Instantly. No buffer.
Okay, so that's the baseline of let's please not live there. On the other side of the spectrum, you have the economist's dream world, the full insurance model. And I have to say, reading this, it sounded suspicious.
It's so counterintuitive. We also call it complete markets. And in this world, you can buy insurance against everything. And I don't just mean car insurance. I mean, you can buy a contract that pays out if you don't get that promotion you wanted.
The text calls them arrow securities.
That's the one. But here is the wild implication. In a world like this, your personal bad luck doesn't affect your consumption at all.
This is the part I really want to drill into.
Yeah.
The text implies that my spending shouldn't track my own income. It should only track the aggregate income of the whole economy.
Think of it like a giant communal pie. In full insurance, we've all agreed to link our fates. So if the economy grows, if the whole pie gets bigger, everyone gets a bigger slice. But if you personally get fired or you get sick, it doesn't matter. You still get your designated share of that aggregate pie because your insurance pays out.
So hypothetically, if the economy is booming, but I'm, say, unemployed and sitting on my couch, in this model, I'm still ordering steak dinners.
Ideally, yeah, because your marginal utility is locked in step with everyone else's. We all rise and fall together.
Which sounds lovely, almost utopian, and also completely detached from reality for anyone listening right now.
And the data 100% backs you up on that skepticism. The text walks through some famous empirical tests that basically ask, so is this true?
There was that Cochrane study from 91.
Right. Cochrane looked at these very specific shocks, involuntary job loss, long-term illness, things like that. He looked at food consumption. And if full insurance were real, losing your job shouldn't change how much you eat.
But of course it did.
Consumption dropped a lot. So full insurance rejected. Then you had Adonasio and Davis, and they looked at bigger groups, like by education or age. They found when a whole group's wages take a hit, their consumption takes a hit too. We just don't share risks across society like the model hopes.
Okay, so we've set the boundaries. We're not Robinson Crusoe. I have a credit card. But we are definitely not living in a utopia where I can insure my career against bad luck. We're in the messy middle.
Exactly. Economists call this partial insurance. And to understand it, we have to leave the utopia and enter what they call the bond economy.
This felt like the moment the text really stepped into the real world. In the bond economy, I can't buy insurance for everything, but I do have a tool.
You have a single risk-free instrument, a bond, or, you know, in plain English, a savings account. You can save and you can borrow within limits.
And this whole setup, this model, it leads us to one of the most famous ideas in economics, the permanent income hypothesis, Milton Friedman.
It is. And honestly, the PIH is one of those ideas that once you hear it, it just feels so intuitive. Friedman argued, we don't just look at today's paycheck. We look at our whole lives. We distinguish between transitory shocks and permanent shocks.
Okay, so give us the breakdown. How does my brain react differently to finding, say, $100 on the street versus getting a permanent $100 a month raise?
Well, according to Friedman, if you find that $100 bill a transitory shock, you shouldn't go out and spend it all. You should save almost all of it.
Because I want to smooth that little bit of extra cash over the rest of my entire life.
Exactly. Your marginal propensity to consume, your MPC should be very, very low. But if you get that permanent raise, that's new money coming every single month. So you adjust your lifestyle immediately. Your MPC is one.
And this leads to that random walk theory from Robert Hall.
Yes. Hall's insight was that if you're a rational person acting like Friedman says, you've already planned for everything you expect. You know retirement is coming. You know the kids will need braces. It's all factored in.
So the only thing that changes my spending today is a surprise.
Is news. Exactly. If your consumption changes, it's because you learned something today that you didn't know yesterday. Otherwise, it's a smooth ride.
But wait a minute. There's a big flaw here, right?
Mm-hmm.
The text says, these early models use something called certainty equivalence. And when I read the definition, I saw why they feel so robotic.
It's a mathematical shortcut. They use these things called quadratic utility functions, which are easy to solve. But the side effect is that in the model, risk doesn't actually matter. The model assumes you only care about the expected value, the average of your future income.
Okay, let me make sure I have this straight. If I have a 50% chance of making $0 next year, and a 50% chance of making a million, the average is 500 grand.
Right.
The model says I should spend today as if I'm guaranteed to make $500,000.
That is exactly what certainty equivalence implies.
That's insane. If I have a 50% chance of making zero, I am not booking a vacation. I am panic saving. I'm eating rice and beans.
And that visceral reaction you just had, that's exactly what was missing from the models. We needed to introduce a new layer to make it human. We needed prudence.
Because prudence is a technical term.
It is. Technically, it corresponds to a positive third derivative of the utility function. You know, U triple prime greater than zero.
Okay. Spare us the calculus. What does that feel like in my gut? What's a positive third derivative?
It feels like anxiety. It means the pain you feel from your consumption dropping is way more intense than the pleasure you feel from it rising by the same amount. Losing the $1,000 hurts more than gaining $1,000 feels good.
Asymmetry.
Precisely. And because you feel that downside risk so intensely, you don't just smooth your consumption based on the average. You build a buffer. You engage in precautionary saving.
This is saving for a rainy day.
That's it. Exactly. You're not saving to buy a boat. You are saving because you're prudent. You know you can't insure against everything, so you self-insure with cash.
And this has to interact with borrowing constraints,
yeah.
Right? Because the other thing Friedman's model assumes is that I can just borrow freely.
Right. But in the real world, banks say no, there are limits, or there are natural limits. You just can't possibly pay back more debt. And if you hit that limit, or even just fear hitting it, your behavior changes completely.
You become hand to mouth.
Yes. If you are constrained, you consume exactly what you earn. So if you get an extra $100, you spend it immediately because you are just desperate for liquidity.
So if we put this all together, we're not these rational robots from the permanent income hypothesis. We're anxious, prudent creatures who were terrified of hitting a borrowing limit.
Mm.
So we curve our spending. We spend less than we earn to build a safety net.
And that creates what's called a concave consumption function. At low levels of wealth, you're terrified, so you save aggressively. As you get richer, the fear fades, and you start to act more like the standard theory says you should.
Now, this is where the deep dive got really, really interesting for me. We've been looking at the individual. Let's scale it up. What happens when you take an entire economy, millions of households, and you make them all prudent and anxious?
This brings us to the Iyagari model. And this was just a landmark framework in macroeconomics because it finally solved this massive puzzle called the risk-free rate puzzle.
What was the puzzle?
Well, in the old models, where everyone was the same and risk didn't really matter, people generally wanted to borrow against the future. You expect growth, so you want to consume now, and if everyone wants to borrow...
Interest rates should be high, supply and demand.
Exactly. But in the real world, the return on super safe assets like government bonds is often very low. The old models just could not explain why.
And then Iyagari comes along with his millions of anxious savers.
In the Iyagari model, everyone faces their own individual risks. Everyone is worried about that rainy day, so instead of a rush to borrow, you get this massive collective rush to save.
Everyone is trying to buy that safe asset to build up their own little buffer.
And when everyone tries to buy the safe asset, its price goes up, which means its yield, the interest rate, goes down. Iyagari showed that our collective anxiety, our precautionary saving, pushes the equilibrium interest rate way down to levels that actually match the real world.
That is heavy. You're saying that low interest rates are, in some way, a symptom of our collective insecurity.
In this framework, yeah. And there's a second effect, too. Because everyone is saving so aggressively, the total capital stock of the economy gets bigger. Iyagari found that precautionary saving boosts the aggregate wealth of the nation.
We have more factories, more capital, because individuals are afraid of going broke.
It's a prosperity built on individual vulnerability. If we lived in that utopia of full insurance, people wouldn't need to save for a rainy day. Savings would plummet, and the capital stock of the nation would actually shrink.
So if we fix the anxiety, we might shrink the economy. That is a paradox I'm going to have to sit with for a minute.
It's the cost of safety versus the drive for accumulation.
But, and there's always a but, even the Iyagari model wasn't perfect. There was still this one piece of data that didn't quite fit, the MPC mystery.
Right. This is where theory collides head-on with the reality of, say, stimulus checks.
We've seen this a lot in recent years. The government sends out checks. Now, according to the permanent income hypothesis and even the Iyagari model, most people should save that money.
Right. The models would suggest that most people have built up enough of a buffer that they aren't strictly hand-to-mouth. So if they get a one-time check, they should save it to smooth it out. Their marginal propensity to consume should be low.
But the data says the exact opposite. When those checks go out, people spend them. The data shows people spend anywhere from 15 to 30% of that money. Like, almost immediately.
Which was a huge embarrassment for the models. They were clearly missing something fundamental about how people actually hold their wealth.
And the solution, which comes from the author of our source, actually, Kaplan and Violante, is this concept of the wealthy hand-to-mouth.
It just sounds like a contradiction in terms, doesn't it?
It does. How can you be wealthy and living paycheck to paycheck?
By making a distinction between two types of assets, liquid and illiquid.
Okay, break that down for us.
Liquid assets are cash, your checking account money you can use right now at the grocery store. Illiquid assets are things like your house or your retirement account. They have a ton of value, but you can't buy a latte with a brick from your house.
And you can't easily cash out your 401k without a huge penalty.
Exactly. Now imagine a household that owns a $500,000 home and has a healthy retirement fund. On paper, they are wealthy, high net worth.
But in their checking account?
They've got $40, and their credit cards are maxed out. They are wealthy hand to mouth.
Why would anyone do that? Why put all your money in the house and leave nothing for cash flow?
Because it's a rational thing to do. Illiquid assets like housing usually offer a much higher return than a checking account. Plus, a house provides a service. You live in it. So people optimize. They pour every spare cent into that high return asset and run their day-to-day liquidity down to almost zero.
So they're maximizing returns, but they're leaving themselves incredibly vulnerable to any kind of cash flow shock.
Correct. So when the government sends a $1,000 stimulus check to this wealthy household, what do?
They spend it because they're desperate for liquidity.
Exactly. Even though they're rich on paper, their consumption behavior looks just like someone who's poor. This two-asset model was the thing that finally aligned the math with reality. It explains why stimulus checks create such a huge spike in spending. It's not just the poor spending it, it's the asset-rich, cash-poor middle class.
Wow. That really reframes the whole conversation about inequality, doesn't it?
It really does. We usually measure inequality by looking at net worth. But what Kaplan and Violante are saying is we need to look at liquidity. You can have two people with the same net wealth, but if one is liquid and the other is locked up in their house, their lives and their financial stability are worlds apart.
So let's just zoom out and look at the whole picture we've painted. We started with this simple idea of consumption being just about buying stuff, but it's really about our survival mechanisms.
We moved from eat what you kill, autarky, to realizing, okay, we can't fully insure our lives.
Which makes us prudent. We become anxious savers. And that anxiety, that fear of the rainy day, is what drives capital accumulation and keeps interest rates low.
And then finally, we realize that in our hunt for higher returns, you know, buying houses, filling retirement accounts, we often strip ourselves of cash, making us surprisingly sensitive to even small checks from the government.
It's such a complex ecosystem. It makes me look at my own bank account a little differently. I always feel kind of guilty keeping cash in a low-interest savings account instead of investing it. But based on this,
that cash is the price of liquidity. It's the cost you pay to avoid being hand-to-mouth. It's buying you the ability to smooth out the bumps.
I want to leave the listener with that one provocative thought we touched on earlier, the paradox of prosperity.
That our fear builds the economy.
Yeah. We tend to think that a better world is a safer world, a world with a perfect safety net. But the models imply that if we actually achieve that safety, if we remove the fear of the financial rainy day, we would stop saving.
We would. And capital accumulation would slow way down.
So it raises this really tough question. Is anxiety a bug in the system, or is it the feature that drives growth? Are we rich because we are worried?
That's the philosophical question hanging over all the math, isn't it? Are we optimizing for GDP, or are we optimizing for peace of mind?
Something to chew on the next time you're debating that $5 latte. Thanks for deep diving with us.
See you next time.